Two central figures in Alaska's corruption investigation are heading to prison. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 28th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, proposed changes to the law that helps Native corporations win big government contracts.
I didn't get the sense that what's going to take place will be dramatic, you know, reduction in our ability to participate. I don't have that sense at all.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Today marked the end of a major chapter in the ongoing saga of Alaska's legislative corruption probe. Former VECO executives Bill Allen and Rick Smith were sentenced in Anchorage for bribing state legislators. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
In 2006, as the state legislature was looking at changing the way the oil industry was taxed, Bill Allen and Rick Smith rented a suite at the Baranoff Hotel in Juneau as a sort of lobbying base for Allen's VECO Incorporated. Soon, they had a third guest they didn't know about, the FBI, which was recording their every move and some of their cell phone conversations. The legislature, after a couple of special sessions, did eventually create a new oil tax system. The FBI watched the whole thing, and so have many Alaskans, as those tawdry and sometimes drunken conversations and transactions have been revealed during the trials of former House Speaker Pete Cott, Representative Vic Coring, and others. Alaskans have seen money being folded into Coring's hand, and Cott sitting placidly as Allen says, "I own your ass." In Judge John Sedgwick's court, Allen and his henchman Rick Smith testified for many hours about what was meant by those activities caught and recorded by the FBI. Now, in that same courtroom, they faced that same judge and pled for lenient punishment for the crimes they admitted to. The result is 3 years imprisonment and a fine of $750,000 for Bill Allen and 1 year and 9 months for Rick Smith, who Judge Sedgwick said sadly, quote, followed Mr. Allen over the line. Both men chose to speak. Smith very briefly said he had disgraced his family and would regret what he did for the rest of his life. Bill Allen had much more to say. "I shouldn't have done it, but I did," he said. Seeing the recordings, quote, "embarrassed me. Hell, I could tell I was half drunk. I made two decisions." Allen stopped drinking and decided to cooperate with prosecutors. He said he had only wanted to do what was good for Alaska, but, quote, "instead of helping him, I pushed him down, really." "Go ahead, sentence me," Allen said. "But kind of remember, I'd done some good." Judge Sedgwick said he had to bear in mind that this case involved hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars. In view of how much Allen's company would have benefited, he imposed the maximum fine of $750,000 and said he would have imposed a bigger fine if the guidelines allowed it. Allen will go to federal prison as soon as a room is found for him. But Rick Smith will stay in Alaska for a while. His lawyers indicated that federal prosecutors have some more work for him to do before the end of the year. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Small Business Administration released proposed changes today to the program that makes it easier for Alaska Native corporations to win government contracts. The 8A program gives disadvantaged and minority-owned businesses a leg up and allows Alaska Native corporations special privileges like going after no-bid contracts. The proposed changes would tighten reporting rules and increase some restrictions, but the initial reaction from Alaska Native corporations is guardedly optimistic. Sarah Lukeen, Executive Director of the Native American Contractors Association, or NACA, is pleased with the way members were included in the process.
NACA and the Native community have been working with the SBA for a few years now on proposing draft regulations. They actually went through a formal consultation with the Native community.
Lou Keen is reviewing the proposals and does not yet have specific comments. Naca's law firm in Washington did dig into the changes and says they should not be a hardship, but may make things more challenging for Native companies. It also says, however, that tightening up loopholes may ultimately be better for business. The president of regional Native corporation Koniag Incorporated, Will Anderson, says while he has yet to pore over the details, his initial reaction is positive.
Anytime you make a change in regulations, it will have, you know, some level of impact. But I didn't get the sense that what's going to take place will be dramatic, you know, reduction in our ability to participate. I don't have that sense at all.
The program has come under fire in recent months because of criticisms lobbed by Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. Her subcommittee oversees government contracting, and she says the program gives too many breaks to Alaska Native corporations. But Koniag's Will Anderson says the proposed changes have been a long time coming and are not a product of McCaskill's influence.
I don't think that it's intended as a reaction to Senator McCaskill's hearings to somehow, you know, create additional restrictions in response to anything that she's pushed forward.
Senator McCaskill's office says she's pleased to see some new requirements, such as that 8A companies should report annually how they or their shareholders benefit. But her spokeswoman, Maria Spicer, says more can be done.
Unfortunately, though, she thinks that these actions don't go quite far enough. She remains skeptical of sole source contracting, and she believes that sole source contracting should be the exception, not the rule, but in this instance, it does remain the rule.
Some Alaska Native corporations were concerned sole source contracting would be on the chopping block, but Small Business Administration Deputy Associate Administrator Calvin Jenkins says that's not an issue. Jenkins says some of the changes close loopholes, like one in the joint venture program. Currently, 8A companies can partner with other, often larger companies. Jenkins says the SBA wants requirements placed on the amount of work the 8A company must do itself.
In the past, our regulations just basically said that the 8A firm must perform a significant portion of the joint venture, but it did not define what that significant portion was, and so it was open to a lot of interpretation. What we're trying to do here is look to define what significant portion is so that it's a lot clearer for all the parties involved.
The joint venture would have to do just over half the work and could subcontract out the rest. Of that, the 8A firm would have to do 40% on its own. Other changes would actually benefit Alaska Native corporations, like boosting the number of contracts joint ventures can apply for. The Small Business Administration will take public comments on its proposals for 2 months until December 28th. Sarah Lukien with the Native American Contractors Association hopes the 8A program comes up at the White House next week, when tribal leaders from around the country meet with President Obama. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the best high school musicians in Southeast get a chance to take their talent to the next level.
My name is Shanae Moore, and I'm from Juneau, and I am singing my brains out.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
President Obama signed into law today a bill that includes retirement pay for former Alaska Territorial Guard members. 23 Alaska Native elders who served with the Guard during World War II had their pay revoked earlier this year by Obama's Defense Department, which said the men provided state service and should not qualify for military pensions. Alaska senators inserted language into the defense authorization bill restoring the Guardsmen's pay. The White House contested it, but the funding survived the House and Senate and went to the president's desk as part of the larger bill. President Obama signed the $680 billion Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2010 today in the East Room of the White House.
So with that, I'm going to sign this piece of legislation. Thank you all for doing a great job.
All right.
Besides the Territorial Guard, funding the Defense Act also includes locality pay for federal workers in Alaska, Hawaii, and territories such as Puerto Rico. It would transition them away from a cost of living adjustment, or COLA pay. Locality pay is taxed and counts towards retirement, unlike COLA. The change had the support of Alaska's congressional delegation and unions. It will be phased in over 3 years. The act also includes more than $300 million to build new facilities at Alaska's Army and Air Force bases. A Southeast Alaska Veterans Health Clinic is scheduled to open this spring in Juneau. The clinic will provide primary care as well as mental health services. It will be located on the ground floor of Juneau's federal building. Veterans Administration spokeswoman Marcia DeVoe Hoffman says clinics already operate in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Kenai.
Our goal, you know, over the years has been to get the care closer and closer to veterans. So opening the clinic in Juneau is progress, but we know that for veterans who live remotely, even from Juneau, that will still be a challenge.
She says close to 8,000 veterans live in Southeast Alaska. The VA announced plans for the clinic in May of 2008. It was expected to open last fall, but Hoffman DeVoe says there were delays.
We have had some challenges recruiting a primary care provider, so that will be one of the, of course, necessary positions that we have to have in place before the clinic can actually open.
The clinic will have 7 or 8 staffers, including a nurse, a health technician, a psychiatrist, and a social worker. It will share some resources with a Coast Guard clinic located in the same building. Services will be free for some veterans, while others will pay part of the cost. Some veterans and other Southeast communities will qualify for subsidized travel. Not all medical services will be provided, and veterans needing advanced care will be referred elsewhere.
You know, when you start needing to have a pulmonologist or a cardiologist or a GI physician, then we would be referring those veterans either back to our Anchorage clinic if we have the specialty available, perhaps to the VA Puget Sound in Seattle, or if it was emergent to a specialist that might be there in the Juneau community.
Hoffman DeVoe says the clinic could be ready for use by February or March of 2010. In the meantime, a VA doctor travels to Juneau monthly and sees patients in the Coast Guard clinic. An organization of Southeast Alaska leaders wants state officials to re-examine the cruise ship head tax. The Southeast Conference is also asking for a regular state subsidy to the Inter-Island Ferry Authority. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
During its recent annual meeting, the Southeast Conference heard industry representatives' views on the cruise ship initiative. Speakers blamed the ballot measure's taxes and regulations for next year's ship changes. Several companies are redeploying vessels to other parts of the world, reducing Alaska passenger capacity by about 15%. As a result, the conference passed a resolution calling for the legislature and governor to consider changing the initiative's terms. Executive Director Shelley Wright says tourism-dependent communities want a review.
The initiative has become burdensome to the tourism industry and was just requesting an evaluation of, is it too much? Is it enough? What's the money being used for? Is it being spent properly? And where is it being spent, right, wrong, or indifferent?
The resolution was released after Conference Board President Maxine Thompson signed it at a meeting earlier this month. The voter-approved cruise ship initiative created a $50 passenger fee, stronger wastewater discharge limits, and taxes on corporate income and gambling revenue. Initiative authors defend the measure, saying the global economy is driving route changes. The Southeast Conference also passed a resolution calling for a regular state subsidy for the Inter-Island Ferry Authority. That entity provides regular service between Prince of Wales Island and Ketchikan. The IFA has gotten appropriations through the legislature's capital budget, but General Manager Bruce Jones says it should be in the operating budget.
Being that this is a recurring thing every year, we had started talking with folks at the state and, you know, the Department of Transportation understood our problem, but they didn't want it in their budget. We talked with some folks at the Department of Commerce, Economic Development Division, and they said, well, we'd make room for it in ours, I mean, you're going to have to carry the ball and all that kind of stuff, and we didn't have a problem with that.
The Ferry Authority, a public entity made up of member communities, hopes for between $500,000 and $1 million a year. Jones says that would support Island to Ketchikan sailings. Considerably more money would be needed to restart the northern route, which used to connect the island to Petersburg and Wrangell. That service ended because ridership was low. Jones says an operating budget appropriation would help attract other support.
We get some funding from the federal government, and the situation there is that we can't use our fares as match money for that. Our match for that has to come from the state of Alaska.
Another resolution asks the legislature to create a mental health program for veterans living in Southeast. If a new program cannot be provided, the group wants lawmakers to contract for regional service. Wright says the resolutions show interest or concern about an issue, but they don't necessarily mean the start of a major lobbying effort.
The board will meet in a retreat, and we will determine what role Southeast Conference will play in carrying through with these resolutions. Is there legislation that we need to follow? Is this just something that we need to maybe send a letter in support?
The Southeast Conference Board holds its retreat at the end of this month. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Fairbanks Catholic Diocese has a new plan for paying victims of sexual abuse by clergy. The amended plan was filed in court yesterday by attorneys representing the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska, or CBNA, who oversees parishes in Western Alaska villages where most of the abuse is alleged to have occurred. The diocese is in bankruptcy to sort out its assets and pay damage claims. The $11 million compensation plan includes $1 million from the anticipated sale of the diocese Pilgrim Hot Springs property near Nome. Bishop's Special Assistant Robert Hannon says other more essential real estate is cashed out with diocese trust funds.
Under the terms of the amended plan, CBNA would sell key ministerial properties to the endowment in exchange for about $7.5 million in cash.
Hannon says the church needs to monetize the real estate through its own trust because it can't afford loans as originally proposed. Under the new plan, the church suffers no net loss to its endowment funds. The funds represent donations to diocese parishes and schools, and the church contends they're legally off limits. Victims attorney Jim Stang says claimants want the trust fund assets liquidated for compensation.
We would expect that the diocese would provide fair compensation to the 300 survivors, and that they utilize all of their assets to accomplish that.
The amended compensation plan does include contributions from parishes. The Diocese Hannon says the individual parishes are participating in the compensation package and seeking protection from further legal attack.
The parish communities, by contributing to the reorganization pool of compensation money, they then would also be then protected under the plan, all the parish communities. And they'd be contributing about $500,000.
Hannon says the two sides will likely continue to go back and forth to hammer out a package that works. Diocese insurance companies are a third party in the case and another major source of compensation funds. In September, a bankruptcy judge ruled out payment from a primary insurer because the diocese lost its policy documentation, but other companies may still provide millions of dollars to abuse victims. Upcoming hearings will look at what claimants are entitled to from insurance companies.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
More than 100 of the best high school musicians from around Southeast Alaska gathered in Petersburg earlier this week to practice and perform as a band and choir. Schools take turns hosting the Southeast Honors Music Festival each year. The event gives the dedicated and talented students a chance to play and sing together under the instruction of college-level conductors. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein visited with the Honors Band and Choir during practice early this week and has this story.
I'm Matt Linhard, music director at Petersburg High School, And the Honor Music Festival is a festival made up of the best high school band and choir musicians around Southeast Alaska. And the way that they were chosen is they all practiced an audition, and the directors of every high school met in Juneau last month, and we listened to these auditions and selected the honor band, honor choir.
Good, this is getting a lot better. I like the fire I'm starting to get from trumpet.
My name's Rob Taylor. I'm from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC, and I'm here for the music festival this weekend. The honor band is working on a pretty challenging set of music.
Trumpets, can I give you guys a letter I, B2? If you breathe together, play together.
How is it trying to bring together a group of kids who, many of whom never played together before, to do a fairly complicated piece of band music?
Well, it's always challenging to do with minimal time coming together as a new ensemble, but one, the students are really well prepared. They're all coming from fantastic music programs where they've had excellent training, and so they show up really ready to kind of add their piece to the whole. And two, they've been really flexible and ready to just try anything. And so we're having a lot of fun, and it's a really easy to come together quickly as an ensemble if everybody is prepared individually musically, and this group certainly came that way because of all the great work that their teachers are doing back home.
I'm Tess Larson. I'm from Quahog. I play the baritone. It's been really fun. We're used to a small band, so it's nice to get a chance to play with a big group and have a lot of different instruments.
And just be careful first when you go on the da, 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 da. My name is David Anderson. I'm the guest conductor for the Honor Choir here. I'm from Seattle. We were just working on a piece by an American composer called Water Night, which is a fairly recent composition, a really beautiful piece that utilizes some really interesting compositional techniques with creating tone clusters and sounds and colors.
My name is Shania Moore, and I'm from Juneau, and I am singing my brains out.
Have you been doing music for a long time, since you were a little kid?
I sing all, like 24/7, and my dad's a music teacher in Juneau, so I'm always immersed in it, and I'm always singing. So.
You having fun?
Oh, yeah. It's the best choir ever.
I'm Holly Reeder. I'm a junior at Sitka High School, and I think the most challenging thing about Music Fest is only having 2 days to rehearse with the entire group, but it pays off, and it's a wonderful experience.
A new movie documenting the life of Amelia Earhart opened in Alaska and across the country this week. The film isn't getting great reviews, but it is generating new interest in the pioneering aviator. And it inspired APRN's Annie Feight to explore her own family's brush with the famous pilot.
It's my favorite bit of family lore. As the story goes, Amelia Earhart crashed near Eureka, the mining town where my mom grew up, and stayed in my great-great-grandfather's house. As it turns out, the truth isn't so far off, but it was more of a forced landing than a crash. She apparently ran into engine trouble over Utah and had to come down quickly in the Tinnick Mining District. John Schmidt is a local history buff on the area.
I was doing the research in the 1980s, so the old-timers were still alive at that time, and one of them, Jim Maxwell, told me that he was first on the scene, and she jumped out of the plane and said, "Where am I? Where am I?" Because all she had was crude maps, and she was following the railroad line from Las Vegas up to go to Tooele.
It was September 30th, 1928. A few months earlier, Earhart had become the first woman to fly across the Atlantic as a passenger. Now she was flying her own plane, an Avro Avian folding wing biplane from California to the East Coast. As she touched down near Eureka, the plane nosed over, mangling her propeller. And that's where my family comes in. My great-great-grandfather owned the largest mine in the area and the only truck big enough to haul away Earhart's plane. The plane went to Salt Lake City for repairs, but Earhart stayed in Eureka for a while. I called my mom's cousin Hal for that part of the story.
And Amelia was invited to stay at my great-grandfather's house, and she stayed 3 days, and the family talk was that she was an incredibly interesting person and had a good time.
The family story is that Amelia Earhart especially hit it off with my great-great-aunt Maud Hillsdale, who was a pioneer herself. Maud was unconventional for her day, willing to swim in public without her socks, drive her car along the rim of the Grand Canyon, and shoot mountain lions. During World War I, she drove an ambulance for the French on the front lines of the war and won a Medal of Honor for her work. My Aunt Banny imagines Amelia and Maud spending long evenings together, drinking whiskey and sharing stories of their eccentric lives.
These were women that were way ahead of their time. I mean, they were adventurers, and they just, you know, they were just breaking out of the Victorian era, and they were wearing pants and doing all these things that men only did. And so I think that they, you know, I never read anything about it, but my feeling is they were kind of like soulmates.
A letter Amelia sent to Maud backs that impression up. In the two-page note thanking Maud for her hospitality in Eureka, she writes, "I shall always think myself fortunate in tumbling into Tinnick, and you don't know how deep an impression was made." The feeling was certainly mutual, and even several generations removed, that impact still lingers. I study the family pictures of Amelia and her wrecked plane and can't help but feel a small connection to the famous pilot. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
To see those pictures for yourself, go to our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.